Rob Burnett started his career interning for David Letterman in 1985, becoming head writer of The Late Show with David Letterman in 1992, eventually becoming executive producer, a job he held through Letterman's retirement last year. He's also the former president of Letterman's production company, Worldwide Pants, co-created one of my favorite TV shows, Ed, and is a 5-time Emmy Award winner and has received 31 nominations. Right after The Letterman Show ended, Burnett continued his work writing and directing the Sundance hit and now Netflix original film, The Fundamentals of Caring. Based on the novel by Jonathan Evason, the film stars Paul Rudd as Ben, a father grieving his tragically lost son, who in desperation dives into caregiving for Trevor, played by Craig Roberts, a teenager with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. The movie is charming and very funny, much like its creator, and we welcome Rob Burnett to the roundtable this morning. Rob, very nice to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a thrill to be here.
It's great to have you on the program. So if I have the timeline right, you had already started working on this film as The Letterman Show was ending.
Yes, I shot the movie in Atlanta. I was prepping in January, shooting in February before the May that the show went off the air. I finished up shooting the movie, came back for the stretch run of The Late Show, March, April, May, and then right when the show ended, went into editing the movie.
So at what point did you know you wanted to do something like this, a movie based on a book?
A lot of the directors that I admire, Alexander Payne probably being at the top of that list, seem to adapt novels into screenplays. So I thought, let me try that, and went to CAA, my agency, and asked them to start sending books. And amazingly, this was the first one they sent. And it was, for me, love at first sight. I thought Jonathan Evason did such a beautiful job with this book that I just saw it as a movie instantly. But of course, you can't buy the first one. So I went on and read 15 more and then bought the first one.
Did you know what you were looking for?
For me, it really comes down to tone. You know, I have a great appetite for all kinds of movies, but the ones that I like the most are kind of smaller character-driven pieces. And this had such a bittersweet tone to it. What I admired about the book and what I tried to capture in the film was that it's a very tragic story, but never told in a sentimental way, told, in fact, a comedic way. And in my first meeting with Paul Rudd, what I said to Paul was, I said, you know, a lot of dramedies, as they're called, the comedy is delightful and amusing, but it doesn't really make you laugh. And I thought together, he and I could do something that would actually provoke laughter from an audience while still staying within itself as a film. You know, the film never gets broad, no one's getting kicked in the groin, there are no talking dogs, and yet in the screenings that we've had, there are big laughs from the audience from these very small situations, and these are the films that I like best.
I do want to get to Paul Rudd in a moment, but let us talk about Trevor, who is the young man, the teenager with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. He's played in the film, as I mentioned, by Craig Roberts.
What do you suppose her deal is?
Obviously, she wants me bad.
She's hitchhiking. Maybe we should give her a ride.
If you're feeling fatherly and protective, Jim.
Nah, forget it.
I'm worried about her parents.
Yeah? Worried about her parents, are you?
Deeply, actually, because she's out there alone. In today's world, there's no telling what could happen. You know, there's all sorts of sickos out there. And quite possibly in here.
Let's do it.
Seriously?
What a find. This is a young kid who seems to just be a terrific young actor.
This is an enormous talent. We went through probably 250 kids before we ended up with Craig. One of the benefits of having Paul Rudd in your movie, in addition to having Paul Rudd in your movie, is that then everybody wants to be in your movie. And we really considered almost every actor of that age for this part. And eventually got to Craig. I had loved him in the Indie Submarine. I thought he was terrific in that. And when we started talking to him and started auditioning him, At some point, Paul did some chemistry reads with some of the finalists, and when we saw Paul and Craig together, we just knew we had something very special here.
Did you know you always wanted a Brit?
Absolutely not. In fact, I rewrote the part to make him English because of Craig. The Trevor in the book is not English. He was not English in the script. And Craig can do an American accent perfectly well, but it was very pleasant to my ear, the comedy of it, and I didn't want to hamper him at all by making him kind of go out of his comfort zone. So I just rewrote the thing to make him English, and I actually thought it, interestingly, added an extra dimension to that character that I thought was a happy byproduct.
When you were reading the novel, when you were working on the script and the character of Ben comes along, were you thinking Paul Rudd?
I don't know if I was thinking it when I read the book, but when I was writing the movie, for sure, I was dreaming of Paul Rudd.
You ever had a Slim Jim? What do you think?
I think it's time. Come on. This is what road trips are all about.
Can't have a bite of the gym. Bite the gym. Nibble on the gym. Bite of the James? Isn't that what they say in your country? Little bite of the James, shall we? Yum, 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 yum. Yum, 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 yum. Little bite of James? Good.
I think what people may not realize about Paul is that he's a classically trained actor. He's a really, really good actor. He just happens to be one of the funniest humans on the planet as a bonus. And I think sometimes that side of him maybe overshadows the other side. And I knew for this, you needed both. And to have him in this movie, it just immediately elevates, you know, all of my silly material. Everything becomes much better than it deserves to be.
This is a road movie. There's the characters go on the road, and I assume writing that is fun.
Well, I love road trips. I'm a big fan. There's something I think very poetic about road trips in general, and in particular for this story, because at its core, in a road trip, you have people that are stationary and moving at the same time, which really appeals to me. They are sitting in that van, and yet they're moving forward. And in some measure, this is a story about guys that just literally and metaphorically need to get out of the house and move forward. So I was very happy that the book had this road trip element to it.
The big surprise for me was Selena Gomez. I had no idea that this young woman had this much charisma, this much to bring to the screen and just be a complete breath of fresh air.
Yeah, Selena's a special person. You know, from the moment that I met her, I hit it off with her right away. She's just a very hardworking kid. Egoless, amazingly, with all that, you know, her life is, and it is an unusual life. It's fame to a degree that honestly I have never witnessed. I've seen lots of it, but she has a molten hot lava version of it that is unusual for anyone. And I think the idea that little girl has her head on straight is a testament to her. And then when you get her on screen, there's something inside of her that is interesting and naturally interesting to people.
So what's the deal with the deep pit or whatever?
Oh, in the 70s, some scientist dudes made a little tiny hole 6 miles deep straight down, trying to get to the center of the Earth. Named it the world's deepest pit.
I think I just like the name.
So your dream is to see a big hole in the ground?
I've always been an overachiever. I'm also going to see my father.
She was terrific in the movie. You know, she was a great collaborator. Again, worked very hard, and I just think has a natural ability. And I think, to some extent, I think is just at the beginning of her. You know, the tip of the iceberg of her acting talents.
There were several scenes in the movie where the character Trevor is obviously he has muscular dystrophy, And there are these moments where he starts to have trouble. He starts to have trouble breathing. He starts to have trouble with his movements. And as Paul Rudd reacts, we realize that the kid is just faking it, and wants to get a rise out of his caregiver. That reminded me very much of the $10 bets that Ed and Mike made in Ed.
You see the manager over there?
Yeah.
$10 if you can get him to tell you where the lettuce is in under a minute.
What's the catch?
You can't call it lettuce.
What do I have to call it?
Lettuce.
There he goes.
Excuse me.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could tell me where the lettuce is.
The what?
What?
What's lettuce?
You know, for salads.
Lettuce?
Yeah.
What kind of jack calls it lettuce?
Is that a fair similarity?
Yeah, I suppose it is a fair similarity in that it's just people goofing around and being silly with each other. And I guess in my actual life and worldview, there's not much more we can do with our little time strutting and fretting across the stage. So I may put in a premium on that kind of idiocy. If my wife were in this interview, she could go on. but yeah, you know, it's, I think there's something about Ed and something about this movie that it's largely about celebrating the small things. And in this movie, you know, it's a movie where the challenge of it for me as a writer was that neither of these guys could ever get better. You know, Paul Rudd's character, Ben, would never get over the loss of a child. I don't think you ever would get over the loss of a child. And unless there's some kind of miracle breakthrough, Craig's character, Trevor, is never going to get up out of that wheelchair. So how do you find something heroic in this circumstance? And ultimately, it's the smallness. It's the, you know, it's kissing a girl. It's peeing standing up. It's, you know, finding a bond with somebody else. It's all of the little things that really, if you expand out from their difficult situations, that really any of us can experience. There's not much more than kissing a girl. Like, that's kind of all there is. Yeah. You know what I mean? So I think that there's something very joyous in the smallness of their of what we're celebrating in the movie, I believe.
There are those wonderful moments in the film that you wrote, you produced, and you directed. Do you like having that control of having it be your project?
The writing and directing, for sure. You know, the producing aspect, I had great help with a woman named Donna Gelati, who's a very accomplished Academy Award-winning director. There's a certain part of the just kind of the business logistical side of all of this that I don't relish, honestly. But in terms of the pure creative side, writing and directing, I find the directing to be an extension of the writing. You know, it's really just visualizing things. If you think of a sculpture in a way, you know, it starts broad with a giant piece of marble and you chip away at it in the writing, and then as you direct even more, and then really the actors in the end give you those fine details. And I find that whole process exhilarating, honestly.
What did you find joyful and exhilarating day to day when you were working in your various posts at the Letterman Show?
The joy at the Letterman Show for me, or in any of this, is that I like making things, you know, and when I feel like I'm making something that I like, I'm never happier than that, honestly. So when probably the most joyous moments for me at the Late Show, probably when Dave and I were in a van with a camera crew shooting remotes, shooting, you know, some silly thing, and then I could come back and edit it. That was as exhilarating as it ever got for me there, because you're there with the funniest guy on the planet, you've got a camera crew, you're shooting stuff, and you're putting it together and you're showing it to millions of people. That's super exciting. Similar for me making the movie, though a completely different form. I'm probably the least cool director that there is, because when I'm shooting, I am so happy and so excited by this. People don't know what to do with this, honestly. We shot this movie in Atlanta. It was 18 degrees. It was pretty miserable, honestly. And routinely, I would walk up to crew members and say, what are we doing right now? And when you do that as the director, fear will strike them dead, because they immediately think you're unhappy and will start saying, oh, well, we're getting the boot. I'm like, no. We're making a movie. And by the end, I had more or less trained the entire crew that whenever I asked somebody, what are we doing, they had to respond, we're making a movie. Because I think you have to stay in touch with the joy and the luck that you have that you are able to do this. It is never lost on me for a single second, honestly.
When you were at the Letterman show, did you still have that joy? Because joy isn't the first thing that I think of when I think of David Letterman going to work every day.
No, and I'm not sure that that's an adjective that would come up early. look, that show had been on the air for a long time, and I'd be lying if I didn't say that it didn't become less joyous as it went on. I think it did become less joyous, and I think by the time we went off the air, I think a lot of us were ready. You know, there were things there. It was not always a fun place to work. I don't think I'm saying anything that other people haven't said. I think for me, from a pure creative standpoint, the evolution of the show in its later years became something that interested me less, because Dave was doing less things. He was still great on the air and very funny, but he wasn't doing a lot of the stuff that I thought was very, you know, was our way of being groundbreaking. By the way, I think he earned the right to do the show that way. He was older, and he did it in a way that made sense to him. I didn't begrudge him that, but for me as a writer, it lost some of its appeal in the later years for a lot of us, I think.
Was there a moment? Was it the heart operation? Was it the birth of his son? Was it a sex scandal? You know, what was it? Was there one thing, or just cumulative, do you think?
I think from a logistical standpoint, the heart operation did have an enormous impact on the show, because when Dave came back from the heart operation and was working his way back into hosting, he was unable physically to come down to rehearsal at first. This was very unusual for us and really changed the day. And from that moment on, he actually then realized that he didn't have to go to rehearsal anymore. And this changed the production of the show drastically. So from the moment that Dave came back after the heart operation, we would start to really kind of produce the show around him and we'd tape rehearsals and show him the stuff we were doing. This was what was necessary physically for him. And then I think he realized that, well, I like this way. And I think that really changed. I think that was the biggest change in the show. When I was head writer of the show, for example, I spent many, many hours with Dave face to face, and you got something great because Dave was a great writer. So when you were in a room with him and you were discussing stuff, he would change things. He would have a turn of phrase. He would, you know, you were collaborating much more. And I think toward the back end of the show, there was much less collaboration with him. It was kind of like we would produce it and kind of give it to him. And I think that was a shame. I think it just took away his involvement to a certain degree that may have been necessary for him. Again, I don't begrudge him that, but I do think it was to the detriment of the show.
Do you keep in touch?
We have not been in touch. I had a lovely conversation with Dave right after the last show. We sat down together, closed the door, and spoke for, I don't know, 20 minutes or so. I'll leave the details of that private. It was a very nice conversation. It was my chance from my side to thank him and explain to him that he really changed the trajectory of my life. He was very gracious to me in return. My relationship with Dave is a very long and complicated one with ups and downs, but I thought this was a very nice piece of closure for it.
I've heard you tell the story that on the last show, the show is about to start and you get a call from Jay Leno.
Yeah.
Right before the show.
Yeah, it was very late. It was right before the show. Jay called, I guess, just to wish us luck and say something nice, and he did. And it was all very, very nice. But I do remember there was a moment there where I thought, I need to get off the phone because I'm going to miss the last show if I'm not careful. You know, the whole Dave Jay of it all, it's funny. I think I have a little bit of a different perspective on all of that now. I think we were in the thick of it. Jay was the enemy. I think I was a little brainwashed to really see him as a devil of sorts. I don't think that's really the case. I think he is what he is. He's a guy. He's doing a show. He was our competitor. And the whole thing kind of seems silly to me now, honestly.
Was there a real pressure for you to be, because when he came on, I mean, of course, the famous story is that, you know, you guys, you go over to CBS, everything's great, it's going well, and then Jay has on Hugh Grant and everything changes. I mean, that's sort of the late shift story there.
Right.
And then you become the, you know, number two and number three in the ratings. Was that demoralizing, or did that set a fire, or did that have an impact on the show?
Well, as I remember it, I mean, first of all, I think the Hugh Grant thing, the Hugh Grant appearance, though, that was the moment in time where they got some kind of crazy rating and that was the final straw. I don't actually think that is what happened. In fact, as I remember it, there were a lot of structural changes within the network. CBS had lost football. NBC started to have a very strong 10 o'clock prime time with ER and Law and Order at the time. And we saw this coming far in advance. I started noticing it. Oh, on Thursday nights, Jay would somehow start to beat us because ER was getting a 45 share, and then they'd have George Clooney on. And of course, people are going to watch that. And so you started to feel the tide shifting there for reasons that were out of our control. It wasn't really about the content of the show. It was more structural. I would say that when that happened, yes, there was a very big impact. I consider it a very dark period for the show. I thought it was the only time in my mind that Dave really was floundering, in my opinion. I think that Dave was uncomfortable with this shift. He lost his footing. He was screaming a lot on the air. He was unhappy. And I remember having a conversation with him about it at one point where I just said, Dave, I thought Dave's assessment of himself was at odds with the world's assessment of him. Mm. Meaning, I thought that it was the only time that I felt like his confidence had been shaken. And I remember having a conversation with him saying, this doesn't make sense to people. They want you to come out, put your hands in your pockets, tell jokes, and be David Letterman. They don't understand why you're so upset. And he shifted things, and I thought things settled down then. And even though we settled into being number two, it was then no longer as much of a problem, I think, when we weren't reacting to it as much on the air. Who knows? You know, it could be that Jay produced a product that was more user-friendly than ours. You know, that I think that has to be considered for good and bad. You know, and what I've always said, and I don't mean this as a knock against Jay. I honestly don't. You know, the popular thing is not necessarily the best thing, right? In many artistic endeavors, you know, what's the most popular movie? What's the best movie? You know, it's not necessarily the movie that I want to go see. I like going to see small indie movies that don't get the same audience as giant blockbuster movies. So that sounds like a knock against Jay or a rationalization. I don't mean it that way. I think there's many different ways to skin the cat in show business. It could be that Jay was McDonald's and people love McDonald's and there it was. And it could be that we were some kind of funky French restaurant you know, maybe that analogy holds true, and all credit to Jay for serving delicious hamburgers.
A couple random things, and then I'll let you go. One is the day after the day after the show ends, the set ends up in the dumpster. You're around for that. What is that like?
It was odd leaving the building, for sure. I felt a little bit like when I was in college. I remember there was one year where I stayed in the dorm a little too long. I was the last one to leave, and it gets depressing in a hurry. You know, suddenly, hey, school's over. This is amazing. We're having the time of our lives. And, oh, goodbye. You're leaving. You're leaving. You're leaving. And all of a sudden, like, oh, my God, I'm the last one here. This is horrible. Yeah. I've got to get out. And I felt that way very much at the end of the show. The hoopla had died down. We were packing our offices. Many people had gone. And it was really time to go. And the visual of seeing the set being dismantled with abandon definitely reinforced that for me emotionally. At the same time, this is what show business is. You know, I never really begrudged CBS any of it. You know, they were ready. The new guy, you know, the king is dead. Long live the king. That's how it works. They had a schedule. Colbert had to get in there. So, you know, I have no ill feelings about any of it, but it was definitely time to get out.
When it comes to your future, and would you like to do more films like this?
This is the thing I'm grappling with right now, actually. You know, I've been incredibly lucky with this movie, and from the success of this movie, I find myself now in conversations that heretofore I had never been in, you know, possibly directing bigger studio movies, you know, all kinds of things like that. And I'm trying to figure out, do I just want to continue doing this, which I loved? You know, I loved every bit of this. And these are the kind of movies I love to see and love to make. You know, or do I want to step and do something bigger? I don't know the answer to that. I think probably the answer, I'll tell you who a great ally for me in this has been, one of the lovely things to come of this movie for me is my friendship with Paul Rudd. You know, I admire his career so much in that he just does things he likes to do. He can do a movie like ours or a movie like Prince Avalanche and then do Ant-Man. And I think if you guide yourself by just doing the things that you want to do, that's probably the best navigational system you can find as an artist, and not get caught up in anything else, good or bad. You know, I'll do something small, I'll do something big, whatever it's going to be. I can tell you this experience has been so lovely to me. And again, getting back to me being the least cool director in the world, I can't help but go on to Twitter and look at the fundamentals of caring hashtag. And like a complete dweeb, I find it exhilarating to see people from all over the world loving the movie and saying it means so much to them. So I'm telling you now, and I guarantee you Wes Anderson isn't doing this because that's an actual cool guy directing. if you're on Twitter and you're, you know, at Rob Burnett One is going to be liking your tweet. You know, I just did it the other day. Some woman from Indonesia, you know, liked the movie, and you know, I'm gonna like the tweet because I just think this is cool that someone from Indonesia liked my movie. I'm like a 5-year-old this way. I can't help it, but it's who I am, and I'm just joyous about the whole thing.
Well, it's a lovely, charming, very funny film. It's The Fundamentals of Caring. Rob Burnett is the writer, producer, and director of the Netflix original film, which can be seen now on Netflix. Rob Burnett, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you so much for spending the time, and a great honor to speak to you. I've admired your work for a long, long time, and it's a great pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and it's a great pleasure for me to be here.
Again, Rob Burnett is the writer, producer, and director of the Netflix original film, The Fundamentals of Caring, now on Netflix. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. I know it's simple, but this choice it is for good.
Choice it is for